Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's the Midday News Wrap. Brian Sears of Maryland Matters broke a big story this week. A blown deadline by the State Department of Assessments and Taxation may lead to a shortfall of $250 million over the next 3 years for county governments across the state. We'll talk about that in a second. But perhaps the biggest local and statewide news in the last couple of weeks concerns the race for the open U.S. Senate seat. Maryland's senior Senator Ben Cardin will retire at the end of his term next January. Former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan surprised just about everybody when he announced earlier this month that he is running to succeed Cardin in Washington. So what does Hogan's decision mean for the Democrats who are vying for their party's nomination? Congressman David Troen and Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks are both making the case that they are best positioned to beat the popular two-term governor come November. Josh Kurtz is the founder and editor of Maryland Matters, and he joins us on Zoom. Josh, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
So this Senate race really did get shook up when Larry Hogan decided to run for this seat. We'd heard from him on numerous occasions saying he wasn't interested in being in the Senate. What do you think caused his change of heart?
I think a couple of things, Tom. I think, you know, he said he didn't feel like he was done with public service and, you know, he was looking for ways to get back into the arena. And, you know, you can take him at his word. I think that's certainly part of it. I think part of it is, you know, he just likes being in the limelight, likes the game, likes to sort of screw up people's assumptions. And he achieved all of that by jumping in.
Let's listen to a little bit of a clip. He was on CNN talking about his reasons for jumping in.
Future Democratic.
Maryland is the bluest state in the country. It's more than 2-1 Democrat to Republican. And Joe Biden won the last election in Maryland by 1 million votes, by 33 percentage points. But I'm not running as Donald Trump. I think you probably know I was probably the most outspoken critic in our party. Standing up to him. And I'm not running for the Republican Party or for any candidate for president. I decided to run to kind of stand up and fight for the people of Maryland and fight against the broken politics in Washington. And I'm going to stand up to people of both parties and just go out there and talk to the voters about why they elected me twice as governor and why I think I can do the same thing representing them in Washington.
So, Josh, electability as a governor, he certainly has proved that. He was elected twice. He ended up his term after 8 years with a 68% approval rating among Democrats and much higher among Republicans. What are the parallels between running statewide for governor and running statewide for Senate? And does he have, a sort of built-in leg up here in this race against whoever the Democrats nominate?
Well, I don't think there are very many parallels, actually, Tom. And yet, he's going to be formidable. Short term, he's by far the best known of the potential candidates. His poll numbers already have shown that he's doing pretty well. But he has never run in a presidential year. He's running at a time when Donald Trump is almost certainly going to be the Republican nominee, and is Governor Hogan himself pointed out in that clip, Trump is not going to do well in Maryland this fall. And then on top of that, you have other factors going on. It's one thing to kind of have an iconoclastic, not party regular when you're looking at a candidate from the opposite party. But this is really a federal election. There's going to be a serious impact on who controls the Senate. You know, this is a Democratic state, and they don't want Mitch McConnell in charge of the Senate. By voting for Larry Hogan, they're going to make it a lot easier. They're going to make it easier for a President Trump to get his agenda through. So there are all kinds of things that make this election a lot different for Governor Hogan than they did when he ran in 2014 and 2018.
The news site Punchbowl had reporting about a poll taken by Ragner Research Partners. This is a polling firm that Larry Hogan has used many times in the past, showing that he leads Both of the major candidates on the Democratic side, Representative David Trone and Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks, by substantial margins. And then, of course, David Trone released an internal poll from his campaign showing that he beats Hogan in a head-to-head matchup. What are we to make of these, you know, competing internal polls claiming that they've got the upper hand?
Well, every internal poll has to be digested with a certain amount of skepticism, but both these guys are using reputable pollsters, and so there's definitely something to take away from them. To me, it's not surprising that Governor Hogan is doing so well so early, just because there is this residual goodwill surrounding him, and voters generally like him. But for some of the reasons that I mentioned before, and we haven't even talked about abortion, which is going to be on the ballot this fall, it becomes trickier for him. The Democratic polls, I think it's probably right that if the primary were held today, Congressman Trone would probably defeat County Executive Alsobrooks. He has spent oodles of money on advertising, on mailers and stuff like that. He has, through the end of 2023, spent $23 million of his own money on this campaign, whereas County Executive Alsobrooks just started going up on TV last week, and it was a fairly modest buy. So, you know, the electorate is just hearing a lot more from and a lot more about David Trone right now than they are about Angela Alsobrooks, but we still have 2.5-3 months until the primary, so there's still a lot that's in flux.
Absolutely, a lot of stuff in flux. I had David Trone on the show here on Midday as part of our Conversations with the Candidates series a couple weeks ago, and in the next week or two, we're having County Executive Alsobrooks. Let's listen to her ad. As you mentioned, David Trone was on television really early and really ubiquitously. I mean, he really bought a lot of ads. So Angela Alsobrooks just starting to do some television advertising. This is her first gamble.
The average U.S. senator is 64 years old, worth $16 million. And the last time they went to the grocery store, I'll let you decide. I'm Angela Alsobrooks, and that's not me. As the mom of a teenage daughter and daughter of aging parents, I know the pressures we all face. That's why, as county executive, I've worked to create jobs, invest in schools, and expand healthcare. You deserve a senator who understands you and who will fight for you. That's why I approve this message.
So, Josh Kurtz, if Angela Alsobrooks, in fact, is the nominee and wins the general election, it would be an historic choice by Maryland voters, given the fact that she is an African-American woman. She'd be the only African-American woman in the congressional delegation and one of just a few African-American senators in the history of the Republic. How much do you think that historical nature of her candidacy is going to impact this race?
I think it has the potential to impact it quite a bit. And in fact, you know, the clip you played of her ad, if you actually see the ad on TV, it's a very arresting image because it has lots of pictures of old white guys basically in the ad, and she's obviously not that. So, I mean, I think that's part of her appeal, and that's, you know, that will provide a great contrast to her and Congressman Trone in the primary, a great contrast if she gets to the general election with Governor Hogan. I thought that ad was a not so subtle swipe at both those guys. So, I mean, it really has the potential to be a big motivating factor for her supporters, but it's a question of, does she have the resources to get the message out as widely as she needs to, particularly with Congressman Trone spending so much money?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that he will spend upwards of $50 million running for this seat. He spent $10 or $12 million running in some of his congressional races for the House. So, and he's, you know, he's a very wealthy man, and he's certainly not bashful about investing his own money in this quest. His ad, or one of his most recent ads, has him paired with Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, an African-American, who is, you know, well thought of in Democratic circles nationwide. I'm not sure how many people here in Maryland pay close attention to him. But here's what Mr. Trone's ad has to say about his endorsement from Hakeem Jeffries.
Future Democratic Speaker of the House, Hakeem Jeffries, has endorsed David Trone for the way he served the people of Maryland. So here's Marylanders reading the endorsement.
David Trone has been a consistent and valued partner
to fix our broken criminal justice system,
eliminate barriers for returning citizens,
and root out systemic racism.
And he's worked hard
to create new manufacturing and tech jobs
in the parts of Maryland too often left behind.
Sign, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
I'm David Trone, and I approve this message.
So Josh Kurtz, obviously Angela Alsobrooks, as you've mentioned, is going to, you know, be fighting this barrage of financial advantage that David Trone will have throughout this race. How does David Trone deflect the charge that he's buying the seat? Because he is wealthy, he's simply purchasing a seat in the Senate. What do you think his response to that charge is going to be?
Well, I think his pivot is that he's not beholden to anybody. You know, there's a huge special interest presence on Capitol Hill. You know, special interests play a lot in political races. They throw a lot of money around. And he doesn't have to be beholden to anyone because he's just spending all of his own money. That's really the crux of his argument. He talks a lot about special interest control in Washington and how he's not part of the game. And I think that will appeal to some people for sure. And, you know, it's you can't say you're not trying to buy the seat when you're putting so much of your own money in. But I think that argument is compelling for some voters for sure.
There are 10 Democrats running for Senate. Trone and also Brooks, clearly the two leading candidates. With these lesser candidates, the other eight, do you think that they're going to be positioned to siphon away votes and from either of the two leaders in a way that can impact the result in the primary?
I have to say, just thinking about that field, there are a couple of appealing folks, but I just don't think anyone is poised to make an impact, even in kind of a spoiler role. I mean, I think we're talking about, you know, handfuls of votes that some of these folks are going to get. I think, you know, if we talk about some of the House races that are going on, some of the lesser candidates could be in a position to impact the result, but I don't think that's the case in this.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. There are 7 Republicans on the ballot in the Senate primary. Larry Hogan, clearly the leader. I think it's a pretty sure bet that he'll win that race, and he's not going to have to spend a whole lot of money in the primary becoming the nominee. Whereas Trone and also Brooks are going to have to spend a lot of money becoming their nominee, the nominee of the Democrats. What do you think that's going to mean to the general election if it's Hogan against one of those two?
Well, there is no doubt that Larry Hogan's going to have a lot of money for the general election. And, you know, associated Republican groups and super PACs working on his behalf. I think the same is probably going to be true for the Democrats. I mean, first of all, Congressman Trone has, you know, seemingly an unlimited amount of money of his own to spend, so that will carry over into the general election. And I think because of the historic nature of Angela Alsobrooks' campaign, if she's the Democratic nominee, she'll probably wind up with a healthy chunk of change on her behalf, both directly for her campaign and with associated groups. The one thing I will say about this is one thing Hogan's candidacy does is it makes both parties spend money on Maryland, which they weren't planning to do, and particularly for Democrats who have a few other vulnerable seats to defend, Senate seats to defend around the country, this becomes an issue. So that's something to watch out for.
Yeah, the chance of the Senate changing hands and Mitch McConnell regaining his leadership role, you know, is very real, to be sure. There are 3, count them, 3 House seats that are now open because of a couple of retirements, and one of them is the seat that David Trone holds. He's running for Senate. So John Sarbanes is retiring. Dutch Ruppersberger is retiring. John Sarbanes representing the 3rd District. There are 22 Democrats running in the primary to succeed John Sarbanes. That's a lot of folks. It includes a former Capitol Police officer who was involved in the January 6th insurrection. It includes 5 or 6 members of the Maryland General Assembly, a couple of senators and a few delegates. How do you see that race, winnowing the field there? I mean, that's just a lot of people running.
Yeah, that's a very tough race to handicap. I guess I would say there are 3 front runners in that race. One is Harry Dunn, the police officer you mentioned. He just became a candidate in January, and he just announced this week that he raised at least $2.75 million in the first 3 weeks of his candidacy. That's a ton of money. The other two front runners, I would say, are the 2 state senators in the race. Sarah Elfrith, who represents the Annapolis area in the Senate, and Clarence Lamb, who represents a district that's mostly in Howard County and takes in some of Anne Arundel as well. They were the 2 big fundraisers in the first part of the campaign. They each took in about $400,000 in the first few weeks that they were candidates, and that's a very respectable amount, but certainly blown out of the water by Harry Dunn. They have sort of political bases, and they're well-known among kind of activist Democrats. Dunn is more of a celebrity candidate, so we'll kind of see how that translates, on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and again, national money being invested in that race for the 3rd District. In the 6th District, which is David Trone's district, the seat that he's giving up, April Delaney is one of the 16 Democrats the ballot in that race. April Delaney, the wife of a former Maryland congressman, John Delaney. What are her chances look like? What's the rest of that field look like in your take?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting field too. And there are a couple of state legislators and a few other local elected officials in that race. You would have to say that April Delaney, who I might add is a lawyer and has been a high-ranking official in the U.S. Commerce Department, she has by far the most money and has been running kind of the most conventional campaign with consultants and, things of that sort. So kind of by those sort of accepted metrics, she is probably the front runner. There's a young state delegate, Joe Vogel, who is running a surprisingly aggressive campaign. I think a couple of other Democrats are in the mix, but I think I would have to say it's Delaney's to lose right now.
And the likely Republican nominee that race, somebody who came close the last time, Neil Parrott, a former state senator.
Yeah, and we should say, Tom, that that's going to be by far the most competitive general election in the state among the 8 House seats. That's an actual competitive seat. And you're right, Neil Parrott is running, but then so is Dan Cox, who was the gubernatorial nominee in 2022 for the Republicans. He's going to have a good chunk of the vote in the Republican primary, the sort of Trumpy vote, if you will. And there are 1 or 2 other candidates worth watching there, too. So not a slam dunk for anyone on either side, I don't think.
Yeah. And we have Senator Parrott booked for our Conversations with the Candidates series, as well as Sarah Elfrith, the senator from Annapolis. And so we'll be speaking with them and then others involved in these congressional races. Let's talk quickly as we finish up here, Josh, about Johnny Olszewski Jr., who has announced that he is running to succeed Dutch Ruppersberger in the 2nd District. There are about 6 Democrats in total on the ballot in that primary. How do you see his chances?
I think they're pretty good. He's far and away, he's the Baltimore County executive. He's far and away the best known candidate. He's got, money, he's got establishment support. I think he'll be fine in the primary. And while he may well square off against Kim Klasick, the Republican conservative radio host and kind of provocateur. She'll attract a lot of attention, but I think he'll be fine in the general election against her, too.
And I want to ask you real quickly before we let you go about this wonderful story that Brian Sears from Maryland Matters filed a couple of days ago about the State Department of Assessments and Taxation screwing up and not getting stuff in the mail on time, which somehow is possibly going to end up in $250 million less revenue for counties around the state. What happened?
Well, it appears as if there was some kind of printing error with the agency's contractor, and they just didn't get the mail out on time. As a result, that could impact the way counties collect property taxes from their residents. So now the legislature is scrambling to see what they can do to, you know, either adjust the deadlines so that the new assessments go into effect, or maybe make the counties whole somehow. I mean, it's a mess, and legislators in Annapolis are just beginning to kind of get their arms around the problem.
Yeah, of course, this is a perfect example of folks in leadership making promises and visions of articulating their vision for what government should do, but so many times it just comes down to nuts and bolts and making things work.
Exactly.
And in this case, you know, stuff did not work in a big, big way. Josh Kurtz is the founder and editor of Maryland Matters, an absolutely indispensable source of information about politics having to do with Maryland, in particular the General Assembly and the races going on for all of the federal offices here in this big election year. So, Josh, thanks as always for the work you all do and the terrific reporting on your team. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. Thank you.
The Midday News Wrap continues on the other side of a quick break. WIPR's Emily Hofstetter joins me to talk about the lawsuit that the city of Baltimore settled with a ghost gun manufacturer. We'll talk about that in just about 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, your public radio has a new name and a new sonic ID. President and General Manager Craig Swagler and composer Wendell Patrick will join me to share the big news about Baltimore Public Media. Plus, Heidi Daniel will bid farewell to Baltimore as the CEO of the Enoch Pratt Library. I'll speak with Heidi, and with Darcel Graham, will step into the role of interim CEO while the search for a permanent CEO takes place. So that's all coming up Monday here on Midday. And if you just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Joining me now is WIPR's Emily Hofstetter with news about a lawsuit that the city of Baltimore has just settled with a ghost gun manufacturer. She joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you.
Hey, Tom. Happy Friday.
Thank you. Happy Friday to you. So this is a big deal. I mean, $1.2 million comes to the city, part of the settlement. Here's a bit of the story that you filed for us a couple days ago.
2 years ago, Baltimore City sued Polymer 80, alleging that untraceable guns from the company's kits were creating a public health crisis. This week, officials announced that the company will pay Baltimore $1.2 million in damages. The sale and advertising of the kits will be prohibited in the state, and Maryland residents will be banned from purchasing them in neighboring states, said Mayor Brandon Scott on Wednesday.
There is also a provision requiring them to provide quarterly reports to the city of Baltimore documenting all sales of ghost guns in neighboring states to ensure that they are complying with this that provision.
The lawsuit builds on a 2022 state law that essentially bans ghost guns by changing the definition of a firearm to include an unfinished frame or receiver.
So, Emily, just for folks who maybe don't cover, you know, pay attention to this really carefully, a ghost gun differs from another kind of gun in one very specific and important way. What's that?
Yeah, well, so first of all, it doesn't have a serial number on it. If you go to buy a regular firearm, it's got a serial number. It makes it a lot more traceable. These guns in particular, they're made by kits. So on Polymer's website, you can buy a kit that allows you to build the frame of a gun about 80% finished, hence the 80 in Polymer 80. And then you can buy your own slide and barrel, and voila, you've got a gun. So it's a build your own untraceable gun.
And is the city of Baltimore alone around the country in municipalities who have sued manufacturers of these kinds of guns?
No, not at all. More cities have been taking this route as well. LA and DC also have, they've already settled with Polymer. They have actually gotten a bit more in terms of money in damages. However, Baltimore is considered by, you know, a handful of experts that I've spoken with to be more comprehensive in that settlement. So, you know, the things that you heard in the story, the total ban of sales, advertising, the really big things, though, are in the neighboring states. You're not supposed to be able to get these kits. So if I go to York with my Maryland ID, they're not supposed to be able to sell it to me. And then critically, as you heard Mayor Scott saying, Polymer is required to send reports quarterly documenting the sales that have been made in those neighboring states. So we have a bit more data through that.
So you can't buy one in Maryland.
Correct.
You can't even buy one if you are a Maryland resident and you go to a neighboring state. And Polymer 80, the company that makes these things, is in charge of, you know, giving the data that says who bought them and where they bought them. What's your take? Is that going to work? I mean, here's the you know, the fox guarding the hen house to a certain extent, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, so, you know, in 2022, Maryland did pass a law, or actually a law went into effect in 2022 that essentially bans ghost guns already. And yet last year, BPD collected 462 ghost guns, and they're already on track to collect a lot this year. So clearly, like, that in itself isn't keeping ghost guns off the street. You know, but as far as these other things, like, those are novel. So maybe it's part of, you know, what Mayor Scott always described as a multi-pronged strategy. You know, it's one of many different things that the city is trying to do in the hopes of even just keeping a few more guns off the street.
It's interesting to me that the city can have a lawsuit that requires that tells people in Pennsylvania and Virginia that they cannot sell something to somebody else. I mean, it's interesting that a lawsuit can have that power and authority. If you're a gun dealer in, you know, Pennsylvania somewhere, it's interesting that there can be a lawsuit that says, nope, you can't sell this thing to Emily or Tom.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's the way that they look at it. It's more that the, you know, it's Polymer, you know, less so than the dealer that isn't able to sell it. But yes, you can't sell these kits made by Polymer. Of course, you know, the thing in the back of my mind that I have to wonder is, you know, that is restricted to the Polymer 80 kits. So there are other companies that make these kits. Polymer 80 is just the biggest. So, you know, you can see where there might be the potential for people to just start looking at different brands.
Yeah. And there are, you know, the use of these things has just grown exponentially. You mentioned there's 400 and something guns in 2023 were confiscated. Back in 2020, it was 29. I mean, it was literally less than, you know, three dozen. It went up to 126, you report, in 2021. So each year it's gone up. So now we're in the 400s. Is it now completely impossible to build a ghost gun in the state of Maryland? I mean, you're saying that there are other companies. Plus, there are other ways of building ghost guns, right? I mean, the internet has all sorts of information on it, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah. So it's, of course, not impossible. People find ways, you know, you can go to other companies, presumably. You know, of course, in Maryland, it is illegal to have them. You're supposed to have a registered gun, or if you've got one of these build your own guns, you're supposed to register and have a personal ID. But certainly there are ways for people to work around it.
It stops the sale in Maryland and in adjacent states to Marylanders. But when it comes to gun trafficking, I mean, people are trafficking regular guns, too, you know, guns with serial numbers on them. There, as you mentioned, there are statutes already on the books that the General Assembly has passed to try to limit and you know, retard that growth. But in it, what's your take on what the actual impact will be in the larger problem of gun trafficking?
You're playing stump the reporter here with me, Tom.
I mean, you know, these things are hard to know.
Yeah,
it's all speculation, but it's, you know, it's a big problem that a lot of people have identified for a long time. You got to wonder, you know, will this be a big dent or, you know, a little hole?
Yeah, I mean, and listen, if you listen to meeting and press conference after press conference with Mayor Scott, such as I have, he will, you know, continue to say, you know, I wouldn't be Mayor Scott if I didn't talk about Congress's responsibility. I think, you know, there is the potential that this could be an incredibly helpful step forward, this settlement with Polymer 80. But this is a national problem. So, you know, it takes efforts from the state legislature and it takes efforts from Congress if we want to really tackle gun trafficking.
Emily Hofstetter covers all things Baltimore for WYPR. Our number here, 410-662-8780, if you'd like to weigh in on the ghost gun settlement that the city of Baltimore has reached with Polymer 80, the company that makes these ghost gun kits. Our email is midday@wypr.org. It's the Midday News Wrap today. I'm Tom Hall. So this is going to be, you know, this was part of Mayor Scott's, this is part of Mayor Scott's overall violence reduction strategy, the group violence reduction, GVRS, group violence reduction strategy, and in the way of, you know, decreasing the use of guns. This is going to be a major element of the campaign as it continues to heat up, Mayor Scott being challenged by Sheila Dixon and others for re-election. In May, the primary is on May 14th. In general, violence on the city streets of Baltimore is going to, you know, still be a huge issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly I have not yet spoken with Ms. Dixon, the former mayor, about this settlement in particular. But crime is certainly a big part of her platform. It's a big part of both platforms. Mayor Scott is, you know, really drilling down on the impacts that the GVRS has had. We saw a few weeks ago an independent study saying that that has made a dent in the gun violence. And in former Mayor Dixon's most recent public safety plan, you know, she has said, you know, that she is going to, you know, continue to look at that and, you know, wait that out a little bit. So that for now is going to continue to be a strategy.
Yeah. And the violent crime, the homicides and non-fatal shootings certainly have, you know, declined in 2023. It's 62 fewer people lost their lives to homicide than in the year before. So there's progress there. But when it comes to carjackings and car, just general car thefts, I mean, some 10,000 plus cars in the city of Baltimore have been stolen last year. It's certainly going to be something that people are going to continue to talk about. I want to ask you, just as we finish up in the last few minutes, you also wrote a story about indictments. In a law that governs officer misconduct. These are police misconduct cases. So some history being made here just in the last few weeks.
Yeah. So, again, I think back in 2022, Maryland had a law go into effect that now if officers see you know, excessive use of force, they have to try and intervene somehow. They have to do something. So on Tuesday, Baltimore State's attorney, Ivan Bates, announced indictments for 3 Baltimore County officers. However, the incident in particular took place in Baltimore City. There was an incident where one officer, Corporal Zachary Small, pepper sprayed a man who was completely bound in the back of an SUV. The man was, complaining that he couldn't breathe. No medical efforts were made for him. At one point, he was dragged out of the car, beaten a bit. And so after analyzing body cameras and interviewing people at the scene, they also decided that there were 2 other Baltimore County officers that could have intervened and did not. I'm not certain yet if it is the first time in the state that law has been used, but it is the first time that the state's attorney here in Baltimore City has pursued indictments under that law.
Interesting. And of course, the person who held that job before Ivan Bates, when she indicted police officers back in 2015 in the Freddie Gray aftermath, that became a very crucial part of her biography and her efforts to win re-election, which she was not able to do this last time. I want to ask you one more thing about the Inner Harbor, because the city council has helped, the developer of David Bramble with his plan to, among other things, construct apartment buildings right on the water where the Light Street Pavilion is now. And the city council took a step making that particular plan, more viable, didn't they?
Yeah, so last week they moved ahead with those potential changes to the laws, two ordinances and a charter amendment that they passed through. So it's not a completely done deal. The full city council still has to vote on it. They'll have at least one more vote this week or next week, most likely. But that plan so far is moving forward.
Yeah, and at least one candidate for mayor is kind of a perennial candidate. Theroux Vignaraja has made this a big item in his platform. He held a press conference a day or two ago at the Inner Harbor saying, it's terrible to have apartments built on the Light Street Pavilion. So, all right, all sorts of stuff going on in City Hall and elsewhere, and we appreciate that you are down there figuring it all out and letting us know about it. All right, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. That's Emily Hofstetter. She covers Baltimore City Hall for the WYPR news team. And coming up after a quick break, a theater review of a new production of Peter Pan at the Hippodrome. J. Wynn Russick will join me for that. But before we go to a break, each week here on our show, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 29 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Police have identified 3 people who were killed last week. They are Dwayne Flintall, age 38, Darian Williams, age 45, and Ricky Cole. He was 69 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.